The love affair, everlasting love, BBC London, 94.9 FM. I'm Jim O'Kay-Fashler. This is our Sunday breakfast programme. It is 16 minutes past 7 o'clock. Now, Christians have no right to wear the cross, according to the Daily Telegraph this morning. We also found out this week who will become the new Dean of St Paul's after the resignation of Graham Knowles. So to consider this and the rest of the week's stories, my paper reviewer this morning is Andrew Copson, who's the Chief Executive of the British Humanist Association. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Great to have you. Can I say that you're growing a beard?
Oh.
No. Actually, you know what? Just to encourage.
You
just
were
to
so
encourage,
shocked when I came.
I was a bit shocked, but that's because I've always seen you very clean shaven. And just to encourage Andrew, if you are a beard wearing man, could you call and give him some support? Because actually, I don't
Rowan
think.
Rowan Williams.
Rowan he Williams. He Williams. Should. Because I don't think my guffaw as you walk through the door was of any.
It's coming off.
No. I don't want, you know, so either beard or not to beard. That is the question. Anyway, any of the stories that Andrew and I are covering this morning, if you want to voice your opinion, I'd be delighted to have them. 0207-224-2000 is the number to call. There's been a minute's silence, Andrew, in Japan to remember the massive earthquake and tsunami which struck the country a year ago. Up to 19,000 people were killed. The disaster also triggered a meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant, and a national ceremony of remembrance had been held in Tokyo, where the Emperor Akihito vowed never to forget the tragedy.
The path to recovery from the disaster-stricken areas, many, many difficulties still lay ahead of us. Let us all, as Japanese citizens, think of the disaster-stricken areas. And make efforts for the recovery and reconstruction.
Very difficult, of course, for Japan as they remember this time, but also big issues around whether or not nuclear, which fuels a lot of Japan, should come under question.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, and the reverberations of that nuclear debate, of course, are being felt all over the world, in this country too, where we're discussing the future of our power and so on. I think that what was most interesting for me, Japan, although it's such a westernised country in its economic ways and so on, in its religious and philosophical life, it's so very different to Europe. And I've been really struck by the way that they've remembered, by having these big civic ceremonies, but also the way that a lot of private remembrance has been tied not to religion as such, but to place and to family. The people who are now returning to the places that were destroyed, and they're building them again, but at the same time they're returning to the places where they lived, remembering their families, having sort of very quite small but quite dignified and personalised memorials put up in these places. That's been really interesting to me.
Well, our thoughts and prayers, of course, are with any families that are affected here in London and further afield, of course, from that disaster. Now, let's turn our attention to the Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholic Church in England and Wales is intensifying its campaign against the government's plans to legalise same-sex marriage. In a letter which will be read out to 2,500 parish churches later today, the church's two most senior archbishops say the change would reduce the significance of marriage. And the letter says Roman Catholics have a duty to make sure it does not happen. This is also on the back of Quakers saying they will quite happily marry same-sex and Unitarians as well.
And liberal Jews. And Reformed Judaism too has come out for gay marriage. And of course, 57% of Catholics are in favour of gay marriage as well, before the Archbishop forgets that in polls and surveys. I think that the behaviour of Vincent Nichols and in Scotland Cardinal Keith O'Brien has just been absolutely disgraceful in the last couple of weeks about this. I mean, of course they have a total right to lobby, you know, as we all do in a democratic country, to have the laws changed. But the presumption that they can somehow define marriage for everyone, when most marriages in this country are not religious. I mean, 70% of marriages are non-religious marriages. In Scotland, Humanist marriages have just overtaken Catholic marriages as more popular.
Right.
So I think it's quite wrong for church leaders to say that they are the ones who define marriage, they are the ones who know what the definition of marriage is, and governments can't change it. So I think that's quite a shame. It'd be interesting to see how their congregations actually react when this letter is read out, given that there is some support there.
But is there not... a value in the statement, and this is nothing about against gay marriage, but this idea that people, you know, in the Catholic Church, for instance, and other denominations are saying, this is what we believe in, and this is why we are against this. Because often we get all sorts of wishy-washy political sayings that never really go anywhere. Mm. At least for them, then, it's clear, this is our position.
Yeah, well, I can be equally clear if you want, their position is wrong. There you are, that's not wishy-washy either. I mean, I think that is their position. And, of course, if anyone were considering forcing them to marry gay people in a full mass in Westminster Cathedral, that might be one thing. Sure. Then one could understand. But, you know, if Vincent Nichols doesn't like gay marriage, then he shouldn't have one, really, is the answer.
Yeah.
Because what we're talking about here is other people's rights and freedoms.
I think some people would say that what they consider to be the gradual erosion of the traditional society.
Well, I know, but I mean, I can understand them saying that, but the fact is that there was marriage before the Christian Church, there was marriage before the existence of the Catholic Church, and there'll be marriage long after the Catholic Church and Christianity, you know, just history. Marriage doesn't start with the Church. Men and women and men and men and women have been coupling off since, you know, we became human.
Sure.
And our closest other animal relatives do the same thing. And I can't think that, you know, churches really have much to say on the matter apart from to their own adherents, where of course it's more relevant. So I think that, and besides, you know, not all traditions are good. Traditions that prevent people who love each other forming some sort of legal recognition of their partnership is a bad tradition, and I think that's not worth defending.
0207 224 2000 is the number to call. If anything that we're discussing catches the attention of your ears and you want to comment on it, I'll be delighted to hear from you. Let's turn to a story we've been talking about all morning, and it's really got my listeners hot onto the collar.
Oh, yeah.
This is the front page of the Sunday Telegraph. You have no right to wear the cross. I say to Becky this morning, that's not quite what it says in the article.
It's really not.
Do you know what I mean? It's just, I mean, talk about a headline. Or you go, like, oh, really? And then you discover, actually, it's still in discussion.
Yeah.
But it does raise some very important issues, particularly for my listeners this morning. We've been talking about it a lot, as you know. The government's position, which is, at the moment, we will find out later on, they have to go to the European Court of Human Rights to defend themselves, I suppose, which two British women will seek to establish their right to display the cross. The former Archbishop of Canterbury is accusing ministers of dictating to Christians, and campaigners said it was another example of Christianity becoming sidelined in official life. And some of my listeners have even gone to the point where they're claiming it's persecution.
Well, I mean, I'm not surprised when they see this sort of headline on the Sunday Telegraph, which, you know, is misleading, as you've said. And the Telegraph and other papers like it repeatedly are having these sorts of headlines. The government, official government verdict, I mean, that's part of the silliness of this story. I mean, the government has to defend the judgment of the English courts in Europe. And the English courts, it was the English courts that all the way through have said that these two women's right to freedom of religious expression does not override their employer's ability to make conditions on their employment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you put it in that balanced way, rather than in the way that this headline emblazons it, I think you'll find that people have sometimes quite different views. Because people realise, I think, that just as your right to, you know, wear a bikini in the classroom if you're a primary school teacher is legitimately limited by your employer, there might be other legitimate limitations that employers might make on religious symbolism. Now, I don't think that the line is necessarily always drawn in the right place on these issues. I think there is more room for people to wear quite innocent symbols of religious expression in their everyday jobs than the Telegraph implies people like me might actually think. I just think you have to be sensible. And when these cases come up, what we do get is a lot of Christian lobby groups, a lot of very right-wing newspapers trying to whip up a storm, and Lord Carey gets wheeled out or wheels himself out or whatever and says, you know, here we are, Christians are being persecuted, it's, you know, lions in the Colosseum all over again. And I think that's an exaggeration. We'll see what happens here.
I'm curious about if it comes. Well, there are two. Obviously, it could fall either way. It could fall on the side of them saying yes, you can wear a cross at work. Mm. And you've just mooted there that to a certain degree, it's not offensive as long as it's not in your face in the workplace.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a question of being offensive. That's the point. I mean, often in these cases, it's for, you know, quite legitimate work-related reasons. So, for example, in the case of nursing, it was, you know, what was being asked was for the cross to be worn inside clothes so that it didn't, you know, dangle about and get in the way and wave and, you know, get caught in things or whatever, which seems to me to be perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, totally.
Perfectly reasonable, you know, proposition for an employer to make. And when you drill down into the detail of these cases, very often, actually, people who, on the first hearing of a headline like this, think, this is outrageous, Christians being persecuted, we must all wear our crosses all the time, and that's, it's a Christian country, blah, 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 actually say, oh, is that the truth? Oh, well, that seems pretty reasonable, actually. You know, why should someone just...
But if an ordinary person who does a 9-to-5 job, who's not involved in any health and safety or any hygiene issue or whatever it might be, I mean, obviously we've got the other case where that woman was, I think she was an airline stewardess, you know, so you have cases like that.
And that was their uniform code.
Which was their uniform. But on a day-to-day basis where someone is just wearing... Does it bother you? Would it bother you? Would it...
Well, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah, but do you know what I mean? I mean, should it be something that we should be concerned about?
Well, there are circumstances where you can see that people might be bothered. For example, if people are in nursing occupations, for example, and someone who's going along who is very vulnerable and there's some sort of medical situation, like, for example, an abortion or some sort of other sort of medical procedure which carries... some sort of moral judgment in the eyes of some people, and they're vulnerable women themselves or vulnerable men in other circumstances, and maybe themselves they've had lots of issues, internal and ethical and so on, and then they're confronted with that sort of visible display. You can think, I mean, there are circumstances that you can imagine where
visible
displays...
But those are the extreme ones.
Yeah, they are the extreme.
So the ordinary... I mean, because most of us are ordinary people who do a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, sure. If you're on the radio, then it's fine, I suppose. No one's going to see it at all.
I don't wear a cross nor a beard, but seriously, 9-to-5,
I mean, I agree with you, right? I agree with you, and in fact this isn't about that. I mean, every, you know, this judgment is not about that at all.
Okay, so but if on the other hand it comes down and it says yes, it they shouldn't be allowed to wear crosses at work, does it not have broader ramifications?
I don't think so. I mean, what the judgment will say if the European court upholds the English court in its judgment will be that in the circumstances here, people who want to claim that their right to express their religion under Article 9 of the European Convention, which gives you and me and everyone else the right to express their belief, people who want to argue that that trumps employer requirements and other sorts of regulations won't be able to argue that.
Right.
But of course, there are loads of conditions where employers might say, well, that's fine, wear whatever you want. You know, we've got Christian working with the British Humanist Association. I'd be quite happy with them wearing a cross. And I'm sure that most employers in most situations would be.
Do you really?
Of course. We don't discriminate on that basis in most of our
faith.
No.
We don't discriminate on faith. Just very quickly, in 30 seconds, a story from the Sunday Times caught my attention. Muslim high flyers share a husband. A shortage of eligible men is driving thousands of women to become co-wives.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite know what I think about this. I mean, the story is presented as if this is very empowered, you know, autonomous women making the decision to share a man. But I think some of the sentences here might conceal some real domestic issues. This woman here, she suggested being a second wife, and both the man and his first wife agreed. I mean, that might conceal a whole lot of pain before that agreement was reached. And I think there are two fundamental assumptions, actually, that are a real problem here. Firstly is the idea that because there's a shortage of Muslim men, Muslim women will have to double up in order to marry them. And I was thinking, well, you know, people marry people from different religions all the time. You know, one of the options might be to marry someone who's not a Muslim, for example. And the second thing is the idea that that it said, well, the implicit in the article is the idea that Muslim women have to provide homes for their husbands and cook every day and so on and so forth. And it's really difficult to do that if you've got a career, so there have to be two of you. And I think, well, maybe he can cook his own dinner.
On that feminist note from Andrew Copson, just give us the website quickly. I've got to go to the news.
www.humanism.org.uk.
Great to have you with us, as always. Look forward to the next time. Keep your calls coming in.